The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll begin with a story from the fiction section of the March 13, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, How I Became a Vet, by Rivka Galkin. When I say vet, I do not mean veteran. A veteran is someone formerly in contact with death on a regular basis. A veterinarian is someone currently in contact with death on a regular basis. A part of me is moved to specify that not all veterans have been in contact with death, nor are all veterinarians so on a regular basis. But I'm older now. I know that many people experience such clarifications as weird. Weirdness does, though, generate uncommon strengths. Such was my experience with the suicide dogs, who, like most of us, were not what they seemed. Joy is an ethical obligation. I was raised to believe this. I have not abandoned the proposition. Joy is the proper response to the gift of life that God or something has bestowed upon all of us, day after day after day. And then at some point, for no more days. Sorrow is an obligation too, and a wonder and a necessity. But sorrow is joy's servant. My father is an Anabaptist. When I was in middle school, I researched the Anabaptist. That one made one's own path to God made sense to me, and that baptism followed rather than formed a spiritual relationship. Sure. But too much of what I read made me think that this was a path through a 500-year-old landscape that had since vanished. I came to the conclusion that my father had made an error. It was the wrong time period to be an Anabaptist, I told him. The sect didn't make sense anymore, I said. It was like pursuing dodo birds, however glorious. He said he'd keep what I'd said in mind. I believe he did keep it in mind, though I don't recall many further conversations about it. My father, now 70, was recently diagnosed with chronic leukemia. The diagnosis has altered his personality in no perceptible way. My father raised me, all by himself, with great dignity. He was and is a practical man. He taught me how to put my hair in a tidy ponytail. He took me to buy tampons when that was required, and he let me work with him on his small goat farm. We had dogs all my childhood, sometimes two, occasionally three. Famously, dogs have a natural gift for the ethical obligation of joy. Our dogs, my dad said, were great role models. He was correct. It is very difficult and also not engaging to speak in detail about dogs I have loved who are no longer with us. I will not do so. I see enough death in my job. That I could become a veterinarian or anything that required extensive schooling was a revelation in no way telegraphed. My first 8 years of school could be summed up by the absence in my classrooms of any sense that joy was an ethical obligation. Those classrooms were not bad places. The teachers were not bad people. My own misunderstandings were the reasons that the settings did not please me. Some of the acts of imagination that we were called to undertake seemed too silly. For example, there was a man made out of cardboard who we were told lived behind the chalkboard. The cutout was stored behind the chalkboard, and we were meant to invite him out for our grammar lessons by calling him by name three times, like a spell. On rainy days, we were allowed to play board games like Sorry and Battleship, both of which I found to be unreasonably aggressive. My father often told me that I made errors of interpretation in my sense of other people. He also told me not to worry too much about any of it. Then, in high school, or maybe a beat earlier, something abruptly shifted for me. As all my peers were beginning to go alfalfa, I started to grow as straight and fast as cat grass, and any piece of knowledge I was offered delighted me, and I devoted myself to mastering whatever came my way. I'm still not sure why that happened. Perhaps new gut bacteria or the intervening hand of the most old-fashioned and personal sort of God? After years of nearly failing each grade, and actually failing third grade, and years of my father being called in for discussions with a series of teachers, each of whom wondered if I might be better served by a different kind of classroom, I was able to obtain a degree in veterinarian medicine. This accomplishment gave both my father and me tremendous joy. But I knew not to rest upon my laurels, because the way we move through time is by an accumulation of unexpected turns. On Tuesday, I saw a cat who had eaten a lily. I saw a 40-pound poodle mix who had chewed through a bottle of Advil. I saw a vomiting St. Bernard who was suspected of volvulus. Around 11 p.m., an older man came into the ER with his male beagle mix, who had jumped out the open window of his truck while it was stopped in traffic. The dog suffered bilateral tibial fractures. All these animals were interesting and worth learning about and deserving of care, but I'm going to tell you about the beagle mix. He had jumped out of the truck and off the bridge over the Arikara Creek on Highway 119. The dog's name was Ohio. His owner, that is the term our ER uses. We have had meetings proposing alternative terms, but for now we are sticking with owner over pet parent or caretaker, said multiple times that Ohio was accustomed to driving with the window open and that this had never happened before. I didn't believe this man. I didn't not believe this man. I put a small Sharpie dot next to the detail in my mind. I myself don't tell lies. This is a handicap. Once I came to understand how much other people rely on lying, I began marking unverified statements like this in the graph paper notebook of my mind. This is essential in veterinarian medicine, where people leave out all sorts of important, unflattering details. I should say that it is 12 years now that I have been working at this veterinary emergency clinic, but it has recently been taken over by a new company. As a result, certain protocols have changed, and not all of them accord fully with my values. Still, working here suits me better than attempting to establish my own practice, which would involve a great deal of client management, design decisions, cute postcards reminding people about vaccines, and so on. I would be a failure. So I stuck to protocol and did not pursue more information about why, that day of all days, Ohio had jumped out of the car. We x-rayed and bandaged Ohio and sent him home with his owner, along with pain medication and information about how to be alert to any signs of infection. After that, I had to deal with a very sick parrot. I did the intake and the workup, and the parrot turned up positive for psittacosis. A strong memory I have from my time as a veterinarian intern is of a shoebox being handed to a client, and my knowing that the shoebox contained a deceased parrot. It seemed to me a very strange protocol, but all protocols have a seed of strangeness within them, around which the protocol has grown, perhaps to protect and nourish that strangeness as much as to obscure it. I explained to the parrot's owner, he said he preferred the term caretaker, that his parrot had tested positive for psittacosis. I wrote the word down on a sticky for him because it's not an easy word to hear. I explained the forking paths available to him, the poor outcomes that were likely, and indicated that the receptionist, Kelly, would be able to run a cost estimate. Kelly was eating a lemon popsicle, but set it down on a napkin and began preparing the paperwork. In the veterinarian ER, almost every day has a walk-on part for sorrow. I moved on to the next patient, a Shih Tzu with paw trauma. Short time later, I was called back to the waiting room. The parrot's human told me that he had researched what I had shared with him and that his bird did not have chlamydia. That was impossible, he said. The bird lived alone. The bird lives with you? I asked. With no other birds. The pathogen here is, yes, called Chlamydia psittaci, and the disease caused by the pathogen is psittacosis, I said. But there are many chlamydias. No, he said, and his voice was loud, angry, and certain. it is not the same as the more famed chlamydia variant. The bird had no bird lovers. It was a solo bird. As we spoke, Kelly was finishing her lemon popsicle with her left hand and tapping at her keyboard with her right. I had no more information to offer this human, and I said, I have nothing more to offer you. And then I went to the back, to the surgical section, to breathe and transition. Such encounters are very fear-inducing for me. I do not have a knack for shaking off the anger of others. I need that knack, but I don't know how to acquire it. I spoke to the father in my mind. In reality, my father was in Kansas and I was in Colorado, and I strongly dislike speaking on the phone. But this father in my mind is kind and useful and a good listener, too. I told him that people are often unhappy in our waiting room, and that was an immutable truth. He said, do you like working there with all those sad people? I often pictured you working more with the worried, well, you know, maybe on a farm. Remember when we met that sheep who was very sociable and not afraid, not like the other sheep? I often think of that sheep, he said. I too often thought of that sheep. Knowing what I know now, I think that that outgoing with human stranger sheep probably had a traumatic brain injury or a tumor. I love my job so much. I said to my vision of the man who was an Anabaptist living in Kansas with a simmering cancer, and this parrot owner is going to try to separate me from this thing that I love most. This job, I believe, is the best use of me on the planet. I do have a small space in my heart held open for the possibility of xenobiology, but I love my job. A benevolent listener might worry that I was overreacting to a single unhappy client owner caretaker, but the new management of our clinic, with its new protocols, unknown and shifting protocols, made me feel and probably be vulnerable. Maybe other instabilities were also at play. I am not going to argue that I am the best veterinarian of this century or even in this zip code, but I am thorough and pragmatic, and I have a gift for setting distressed animals at ease, a gift not quantifiable. I communicate well with creatures that can't speak, including infants, though it was once suggested to me that infants are very drawn to people who wear eyeglasses. So maybe I am being prideful. Maybe it's just my glasses. I am also good, albeit not exceptional, with run-of-the-mill adults. This is because when I was in college, I followed around an obstetric nurse, April, who went to church with my father. An obstetric nurse lives in chronic extremeness. No matter how normal a delivery is, the day a human or any animal gives birth is an exceptional day. That is how April explained it to me. Every time she walked into a room with a new patient, she would say, "All right, honey, this is going to be a red-letter day." And then, whatever April would do, she would announce, like, "We're going to get this IV place for you," or "We're going to get this Pitocin drip started," or "We're going to bring you some ice chips." "You might think I'm repetitive and insincere," April said on our first break, sharing cheddar goldfish with me, "but I speak the way I do for a reason." I took note of April's use of we and the habit of speaking each action. This had an effect on the laboring women not unlike that of the more fantastical fictional scenes of communicating peace or dominance to wolves in the wilderness. "Everyone gets negative online reviews," my supervisor George told me the day after the parrot person had written up a vicious review. "Yes, we know that," I said. "And customers expect miracles," which, George was saying, "is understandable," I was adding. "But we have a protocol here, as you know. Once a team member reaches a dozen three-star or below reviews within a 12-month period, it should be calculated with percentages, not raw numbers." "I can see good reason in that," George said. "Absolutely, but that's not what we do. I'm letting you know simply that you are now one shy of this number, and..." I felt humiliated by the conversation. Also, I felt that there was an error in it, a religious error, an error in how goodness was being assessed and invited. what I said out loud was, we're going to improve this situation. In my heart, I said, he doesn't know me. I am often unknown. I will help him to know me. I don't fear death. I assume the other side of the door is okay. In the lowest moments of my life, when I have thought that it might be useful to exit my situation more fundamentally, I assume everyone feels this way, at least briefly at one time or another. It was not fear that stopped me from taking action. Death is a mercy when it's time. That's how I was raised, and I stand by it. All the more so after years of bringing many a beloved creature across that greatest of divides. I feel like mentioning that I get consistently high marks for that service. I don't rush, I don't giggle, and I don't coerce people into sharing their emotions with me. I pay attention, instead, to the creature. Working again in the ER, the evening following the discussion about my reviews, I met, one after the other, two more dogs, each belonging to a different household. Both had leaped over the bridge on 119, as Ohio had. It might appear that I am telling you about how my livelihood was threatened by poor reviews, but I am telling you instead something about dogs and their special gift and maybe what we or I can learn from them. The first of the leaping dogs that night was a terrier mix. Terriers are deranged animals who could probably teach us a lot about how brains pointlessly track small movements and changes. These traits of theirs far exceed those needed to hunt small, rustling prey. My father and I raised a terrier mix whom we mislabeled as selfish. All she wanted to do was play ball. Until we saw her sleep by the door for three nights while her dog sister was away at the hospital. This terrier mix, Sushi, was 7 years old. He smelled like skunk. His human parent specified that he did not usually smell this way. But the human parent reported not seeing any skunk after having retrieved Sushi from his jump over the bridge. X-rays revealed no fractures. His human parent then asked if they could go. I deferred to Kelly, who was again working the desk and who is not judged by star ratings, since she is the person designated to communicate pricing. Not long after Sushi left, the other dog came in, same leaping, same place. This dog had been on a walk, on a leash. He was a spectacular Irish wolfhound. He looked like the ghost of a horse. He looked like he had worked with headless people in a previous life and had not let those people feel ashamed about having no head. The wolfhound, whose name was Aggie, had tremendous grace and several contusions. He needed to be worked up for fractures, and for the mystery of why a dog, generally obedient, had gone wild. The owner, an older woman with a long braid, told me that she had thought, is this mad cow disease? Is this some kind of poison in the brain? Do I have mad cow disease? Is it a climate thing? As Aggie was waiting for x-rays, I worked triage. We had a sleepy cat suspected of obstruction, a cat with a chronic cough, a listless dog with diarrhea who needed IV fluids and a workup. A parrot was brought in with reports of seizures. I could hear this being explained to Kelly. A parrot. Fear tiptoed clumsily down all the corridors of me. Then, when I peeked into the waiting room, I saw it was a different parrot and a different parrot person. She suddenly gets stiff and falls off the bar and then lies on the floor of the cage, the parrot person said. She lets me pet her while she's there and she stares at me like she's looking for help. And then after a few minutes, she's well again. It's happened a few times. I did not intuit that she was lying, the human. She looked stunned, like a cow in a traffic jam. I mean that in a nice way. Obviously, one doesn't side with the cars. And then she said, why was a dog with diarrhea seen in front of a parrot with seizures and confusions? Dogs have diarrhea all the time, she said. As I tried to answer her, she began to film me. So now I had exceeded my allotment of negative reviews. It's not about understanding these people. It's about defanging these people, Kyle said to me. Kyle was young, maybe 25. He was a relatively new vet tech with us. He had a cheerful iguana tattoo on his neck and fingernails painted hot pink. He seemed fond of me, which I treasured. Avoiding making enemies has arguably prevented me from making friends, or that is something the father I keep in my mind has sometimes said. I said I didn't believe people could be defanged. Some people have fangs and like to bite other people, and that's the way of the world. Kyle said he had a friend who was a herpetologist. He can walk through the woods and pick up all kinds of snakes that the rest of us would need to hide from. These snakes are still snakes, even venomous snakes, but he's not afraid, Kyle said, because he knows how to handle them. Well, I'm also reasonably good at handling snakes, I said. Just take a deep breath, he said. When someone treats you like that, you just say to yourself, they don't know me. My mind returned to the jumping dogs, to that inky point I had made when the first dog, Ohio, was brought in. Why had he leaped out of his owner's truck? Why that day and not another day? Two dogs cannot form a pattern, but three. Three is not chaos. Kyle suspected that the dogs were depressed. Kelly said that she didn't think that dogs got depressed. That's just not what dogs were like. Sad dogs, sure, but no, not depressed. She said she had known of a cyclist who had died near the bridge, and perhaps the dogs were seeing his ghost. I said to myself, these three dogs, Ohio and Sushi and Aggie, are reasonable dogs. They are doing this for a reason. When I brought up the mystery to George, the supervisor, he said I needed to focus on what and who was in front of me, and that if I incurred one more online bash, and it seemed to me almost certainly what that second parrot person would do, I would be taking 2 weeks unpaid leave for sensitivity training and client management skills, and that even at the end of that training, he could not guarantee me my position back. And he also said it would be best if I wore my hair in a bun, that it was too long to be worn in a ponytail. A job listing came up at a horse farm about 45 minutes outside town. It was a position for 2 days a week. I have not spent much time with horses. Although their eyesight is partly monocular, and their visual range is so much more than our own humble 180 degrees, they share with us the specificity of a world seen from around 5 feet above the ground. When walking, we aren't too different. I shared this thought, and it was not unwelcome, with the woman, recently widowed, who had placed the job posting. She had 16 horses and ran a riding school and had a very cluttered home. Very clean stables, though. She said that it was difficult when she lost her husband, but what haunted her nights was a horse of hers, spooked by a storm, who got tangled in some old rope left on a fence post. What she needed was pretty routine care for her horses, care that had previously been done by her husband. Before I left, she went into her cluttered home and came out with a cookbook that contained favorite recipes from our nation's first ladies, from Martha Washington through to Jacqueline Kennedy. I drove away reminding myself of my skills with animals and also with the human species. To the small puppet of my father that I keep in my mind, I said, so many well-meaning people and small-minded people, too, told me nothing would come of me, and yet here I am, replete with skills. How had this happened? And had I lost my way? Did I feel hopeless, and like if I were fired from my job, all that structured my life in a good and purposeful and meaningful way would be lost? I didn't feel like that. But also I did feel like that, acutely. I felt there was a very specific place for me in the world, a place that made sense for me, and that there were very few or maybe no other such places. I was less afraid of death than ever. And a weird feeling was growing inside of me, a feeling that I had never really become a vet, a feeling that I had tricked everyone, I was no more real than that cardboard man obsessed with grammar who lived behind the schoolroom chalkboard. I was already dead, almost. The puppet of my father shook his head. "You see," he said, "this is one of the many reasons that I remained an Anabaptist." The puppet of my father had a tendency toward oracular pronouncements. Was that his fault? My understanding was that this happened when I myself hit a mental block and could not see further. He was not perfectly reasonable, not even the real him that lived outside my mind. He had not wanted to take the medicine his doctor prescribed because it made his feet tingle, and he found this intolerable. And we had argued about this, and I treated him as if he were a child, which was wrong. I had not made him happy or well. I was failing the most basic ethical obligations. Perhaps I was no longer hewing closely to April's ways of being, the ways that had paradoxically, by following them, allowed me to be myself. Too bad I didn't like myself much anymore. I found I was right there, on the bridge, the one over the Arakari Creek on Highway 119. It was windy. The water was running high and brown like melted Neapolitan ice cream. Was the water singing some song as it hurried forward so confidently? Sure it was. But its flow looked correct from where I was standing, and looking at it with my eyes and no one else's. I wanted to see what the dogs had seen. I don't enjoy jumping. I thought I could scramble down the bank instead of jumping. I was on the path set by the dogs. Though absent, they were my guides and role models. The mud had limestone bits, and dandelion and foxtail did much of the work of holding the soil in place. It seemed unremarkable, even as there was reason to expect something very remarkable down there, closer to the water. I had a giddy sense of expectation, as if I were going to see a gorilla give birth, which I did once witness. I felt that I was nearing a knowledge or darkness. It was a childhood feeling, which meant that I trusted it. There was a magnet or a hole or energy perceptible to certain animals, and I, who felt myself to be an animal locked out of certain perceptions, was approaching it. It was muddy, and I was muddy, and the light of the moon was bright and loud. You may not believe it. And I may not tell anyone. I learned something about those dogs and from those dogs. They were not hurrying away from this world. They were not pursuing death. They were not deranged. They were not even melancholy. There was a smell. I could not place it. It is because our nostrils are too small and too close together that our scent location is so weak. So I lay down flat on the damp earth with my face tilted upward. I tried to be as quiet as possible. I closed my eyes and concentrated and imagined myself to be harmless, even wounded. And I tried very hard to be as if I could rely only on my sense of smell. I tried to locate that scent as precisely as I could, wishing my nostrils farther apart from each other. I did not succeed at that. But what I saw in the root system of a bankside oak tree when I opened my eyes was a collection of marbles, the marbles being eyes. What I saw from down in the mud was a crowd of minks, a family, most likely. What had made those dogs jump was the scent of those minks. You might call that scent the scent of love. It had been an error that those dogs had made. But an error of the heart, my dad said to me, there in the mud. So, a worthwhile error. We have to make our own rules and our own judgments and not curse ourselves or others for the way we arrived in this world. Also, we need to build a higher railing on the bridge or otherwise devise a way to spare those dogs from injuries. This is what I wanted to share with someone. I couldn't tell my father, whom I often lied about, pretending that he loved me in a beautiful and flawless way, and that I loved him in a beautiful and flawless way. When I had last visited him, I found a piece of paper near his bed on which he had written three columns: close friends, okay friends, and not friends. It was only 11 people or so, and half of them I didn't know. There was too little that I knew about this man, who had at times yelled at me and at times asked me to finish my entire glass of milk, and who had let me sleep with the baby goats when I was afraid. Have I fulfilled my duty of joy to him? There in the mud, I began to. Though I had been a veterinarian already for many years, that was when I became, in the eyes of the minks and myself, a true vet. And now, from the Annals of Education Department of the March 7th, 2023 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, The Right Side of History: How Should Historians Respond to the Urgency of This Current Political Moment, by Emma Green. The trouble started with a writer on Deadline. James Sweet, who goes by Jim, is a white professor of African history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the former president of the American Historical Association. Every month, he was tasked with writing a column for Perspectives on History, a magazine put out by the association, which is mostly read by academics. Last summer, while he was on vacation in Ghana, he was struggling to come up with a column idea, and so he started looking around for inspiration. At his hotel one morning, a group of African Americans began trickling into the breakfast bar, he wrote. Sweet noticed that one of them had brought along a dog-eared copy of the 1619 Project, a book-length expansion of the New York Times Exploration of America's Founding, which looks at the country's origins through the lens of slavery and racism. Later, Sweet and his family visited Elmina Castle, a slave trading post on the Gulf of Guinea. Our guide gave a well-rehearsed tour geared toward African Americans, despite the fact that less than 1% of the Africans passing through Elmina arrived in North America. To Sweet, these examples illustrated the temptation of presentism, a concept often used by scholars in a derogatory manner, referring to studies of the past that are distorted by the ideas of the present. In his essay, he leaned on some other examples, such as The Woman King, a popular film from last year, which seemed to him to twist violent episodes of African history into a story of black feminist triumph. He also brought in Supreme Court decisions written by Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who made historical arguments to support decisions on guns and abortion rights. It was a list of strange bedfellows, but his point, or at least the point he wanted to make, was methodological. We're being inundated with history at all sorts of turns. No one is immune to that, Sweet told me recently. Certain narratives are harnessed in the service of particular political perspectives. For me, that's a dangerous trend for professional historians to get drawn into. The piece was published on the afternoon of August 17th. Sweet, who is also a high school football coach, was walking off the field after practice when he got the first indication that something was up, an email in his inbox from a famous historian that said, quote, "Wow, just wow," end quote. By the time that Sweet got home, his piece was blowing up on Twitter. Oh, hell, he recalled thinking, here we go. A number of academics were exasperated that Sweet criticized the 1619 Project, which had already come under attack from other white guy senior historians. Others were confused that he used non-academic examples to illustrate supposed problems in academic history. Some were incredulous that the leader of the country's premier history organization seemed to dismiss work that was focused on fundamental issues of power. Jamel Bowie, a columnist at the Times, tweeted, bold take from checked byline, the president of AHA, that race, gender, sexuality, nationalism, and capitalism are, quote, contemporary social justice issues which have been imposed on the study of history, end quote. Many observed that Sweet's targets for criticism were nearly all black. One junior faculty member at a private Catholic university wrote about the essay on his blog, saying that he, quote, cried rereading it, seeing starkly the smug condescension and slap in the face to professional historians of Africa and to black Americans. And yet supportive emails also started flooding in, often from other white male professors. One academic who works on a prominent African-American studies journal wrote, quote, the issues you identified are so pervasive, especially in my field, that I have come to question the worth of history and the humanities, end quote. Another professor, a self-described centrist Democrat, echoed Sweet's concerns about how history is used as a political tool. But, like many of the people who reached out to Sweet with support, he didn't want to post the sentiment online. I'm not close enough to retirement to get fired from my job, he explained. It was a strange juxtaposition. If someone looked only at Twitter, they might reasonably assume that Sweet is a racially insensitive crank. But if they peered into his inbox, they would get the impression that he is a brave free speech warrior. This split-screen view is an indication of what academic history has become, a weapon in America's daily war over contemporary politics. On the Internet, historians have become influencers, judges who rule on the present using the gavel of the past. To Sweet, this kind of behavior inevitably leads to bad history. The allure of political relevance, facilitated by social and other media, encourages a predictable sameness of the present in the past, he wrote. This sameness is ahistorical, a proposition that might be acceptable if it produced positive political results, but it doesn't. Jim Grossman, the executive director of the association, called Sweet and explained that the AHA was potentially at risk of losing hundreds of members. They discussed the possibility of the AHA issuing a retraction, but decided against it. Ultimately, Grossman asked him to draft an apology, which specifically included two things: an admission that Sweet had harmed the AHA, and a clarification that responsibility for the piece was Sweet's alone. Grossman says that it was more of a suggestion. The organization basically put me on an island and said, you need to own this thing, Sweet told me. Sweet apologized, drawing the ire of right-wingers on Twitter who felt that he was yielding to the woke academic mob. White supremacists started trolling the AHA's account, prompting the organization staff to take the account private for a brief period. Sweet became his own mini news cycle, fodder for analysis in the Washington Post and on Real Time with Bill Maher. But eventually, the commentators moved on, leaving historians to their own debate about who and what their work is for. Sweet is part of a dying breed of old school academics. He has a secure job in a field where tenure track positions are dwindling. He relishes writing books and teaching, not influencing public policy or the news cycle, which many academics now consider part of their job. His manuscripts have led him aboard a mutinous 18th century British slave ship into the religious lives of early modern Africans and along the unlikely travels of an 18th century slave and healer named Domingos Alvarez. In a field that's deeply divided over whether archives can do justice to the stories of the marginalized, Sweet is an archives guy. To tell Alvarez's story, he sifted through a 600-page Inquisition file, along with Catholic parish records, travelogues, and census records. And as a white expert in African history, he has become part of a larger debate about whether someone should teach a history that is not their own. Sweet finds it strange that he's been cast as a reactionary conservative. He went to public schools in Charlotte, North Carolina, that had only recently been forced to integrate by the Supreme Court. He grew up in a working-class community where many people have since become Trump supporters. But Sweet himself has always been unabashedly liberal. he found his way to Latin American history and later African history through the encouragement of a mentor at the University of North Carolina, where he went to college. In graduate school, he discovered that there wasn't a lot of scholarship on the beliefs and cultures of the wildly diverse African groups that were brought to early modern Brazil via the slave trade. He would eventually make this the focus of his career. His second book, which was on Alvarez Charts, A Map of the Atlantic World, The Kingdoms of West Africa Connected by Ship to the Rural Towns and Unruly Cities of Brazil, Crisscrossed by Portuguese Slavers and Watched by Suspicious Inquisitors, who were deeply shaped by notions of racial and biological hierarchy. By necessity, it is a work closely focused on the power of racism and white supremacy. The question of how much historians should pay attention to these topics has been a subject of intense public discussion, and the AHA has been actively involved. After Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis took over a small public school, New College of Florida, and banned a new advanced placement course in African American studies in Florida classrooms, the AHA signed on to a statement saying that these, quote, attacks threaten public understanding of our nation's history and culture, end quote. Sweet has played a role in the organization's advocacy work. His first perspectives column as president decried Republican bans on divisive concepts such as race, gender, and sexuality. In a video on the association's website titled Teaching with Integrity, Historians Speak, Sweet points out that race and slavery are fundamental features of every American's history. I have a very difficult time understanding the kind of fear that this stokes, he says, referring to GOP legislators. My question back to them would be, what are you scared of? Sweet thinks some of the backlash to his essay came from colleagues who saw the piece as a snub against the AHA's advocacy efforts, which is not what he intended. He told me that there is such a great urgency in the profession right now for historians to have public voices because of the way that history has been under attack. His actual target was the, quote, professional historians who believe that social justice should be their first port of entry, which is not the way that we've traditionally done history, end quote. Even though archives, especially those that deal with slavery, are often partial accounts created by people who oppressed others, that, quote, doesn't mean you can use literary devices or use a fragment of evidence and try to embellish it into history, end quote, Sweet said. He sees these methodological approaches as dangerously close to the selective approach to history that he believes has been deployed by the American right. It is no surprise that Sweet led his essay with a critique of the 1619 Project. He has written about it repeatedly, including for an earlier column in Perspectives and a recent forum in the American Historical Review, once praising it for, quote, its singular commitment to challenging the triumphalist narrative of American democracy, end quote. It is difficult to overstate how much the 1619 Project, which has expanded to include curriculum guides and history lesson plans, has shaped recent conversations about the nature and purpose of history, even though Nicole Hannah-Jones, its creator, has described it as primarily a work of journalism. When I asked Sweet for concrete evidence of where actual academics are using history as, quote, an evidentiary grab bag to articulate their political positions, end quote, as he put it in his essay, he only gestured vaguely at books and syllabi that have circulated online. It was almost as if he were responding to a diffuse political sensibility in his field rather than arguing against a particular person or school of thought. Other historians whom I spoke with had mixed impressions of how widespread this sensibility is and whether it has had a real effect on scholarly work. The love of complex narratives sits at the center of what a lot of academic historians are doing, certainly what we're teaching, Angela Dillard, the chair of the history department at the University of Michigan, said. The notion that academic history is driven by identity politics tends to feel like a little bit of a straw man, she said. Conversely, David Blight, a Yale historian of the Civil War, told me that, quote, there are tendencies these days among younger historians, but not just younger historians, to sometimes put advocacy ahead of scholarship, end quote. Blight himself has long engaged in political advocacy, but thinks issues of race, gender, and sexuality have come to dominate fights over history. If we get so obsessed with them, we can lose sight sometimes of other bigger questions, he said. It's possible that Sweet had one specific person in the back of his mind as he wrote his essay. Years ago, he served as the dissertation advisor to Jessica Krug, a student who studied fugitives from the Atlantic slave trade in 17th century Africa. Sweet described Krug as having an activist bent and a difficult personality, and indicated to me that their relationship was strained. When Krug later turned her dissertation into a book, the editor of a journal about slavery asked Sweet to review it. But Sweet declined because of the conflict of interest created by his mentoring role. The editor was surprised to learn that Sweet had advised Krug in the first place. He writes back to me and says, "Well, it would have been nice if she had at least acknowledged you in the book," Sweet told me. He observed to me that her book, which was completed after his tutelage ended, was more overtly political than her original dissertation. Krug could not be reached for a comment. In the fall of 2020, Krug, who was by then an associate professor of history at George Washington University, posted a widely read confession on Medium. She had been masquerading as Black and Latina when, in fact, she was a white Jewish woman from suburban Kansas City. When Sweet's column went viral 2 years later, a few of his Twitter critics speculated about whether the two incidents were related, as though Sweet had somehow indulged or enabled Krug's racial charade. Like many others in Krug's life, Sweet was blindsided by Krug's revelation. When I pressed him, he reflected that working with her may have shaped the skepticism that he expressed in Perspectives. I did think that she used really narrow evidence to make bigger arguments that I wasn't completely convinced by, he said, and I thought it was in the interest primarily of politics. He added, that experience probably influences some of the ways I think about the profession more broadly. The other thing Sweet was clearly thinking about was social media. Sweet is not on Twitter. I'm not a clout chaser, he told me, but many historians are active on the site. Just look up at Twitterstorians. The trend took off in the Trump years when prominent scholars amassed huge followings debunking Trump's claims about American history and comparing the MAGA movement to fascism. But plenty of PhD students and underemployed historians have become Twitter famous, too, by eagerly weighing in on whatever controversy is trending in the news or online. In some ways, the platform has evened out the playing field of expertise. One doesn't have to clear the hoops of tenure to earn respect as an academic. There's a tension in the fact that historians want to have public voices, Sweet told me. If everyone who has a PhD and can claim a Twitter account is a public intellectual, how do you separate those who are producing new knowledge from those who are simply being public intellectuals? Sweet's anxiety about the need for historians to produce new knowledge and his desire to define the field by this act stems from a debate that's been happening behind the scenes at the AHA. After Sweet took on his role as president last winter, the AHA Council convened an ad hoc committee to develop the association's guidelines on what counts as scholarship. Traditionally, a historian who goes up for an academic job, tenure, or a promotion needs to have written a book, typically something called a single-author monograph. Under the proposed new guidelines, which the committee developed, additional categories of scholarship would count textbooks, reference guides, op-eds, and testimonies to legislatures and regulatory agencies, along with more novel ideas of scholarship, such as consulting on the development of video games and, quote, expanding our media presence across a wide range of platforms, end quote. university history departments can adapt these guidelines as they wish, but the AHA's imprimatur is influential. Grossman, the AHA executive director, has pushed for the expanded guidelines on the principle that the diffusion of knowledge is just as important as its creation. On this point, the two gems are at odds. Sweet worries about these new kinds of materials replacing monographs, in large part because he is unsure of how they can be rigorously peer-reviewed. The odyssey of researching and writing a monograph endows us with the expertise and gravitas that define us as historians, Sweet wrote in a column in the February 2022 issue of Perspectives. Absent this high standard, we lose intellectual authority and political credibility. Indeed, without it, I fear we run the risk of becoming the same as the trolls and amateur hacks who challenge our expertise. Rita Chen, a history professor at the University of Michigan who led the ad hoc committee, told me she thinks the new guidelines simply reflect the life of academics at universities with heavy teaching loads. Some scholars don't have time to write fully researched books, but they might still be able to contribute valuable scholarly work in other forms. She said that some of the resistance to broadening the definition of scholarship comes down to gatekeeping. The monograph is an easy way to distinguish the work of academic historians from that of the other civilians who love history, such as Civil War reenactors or amateur bloggers. That line is more blurry in the discipline of history because we are a discipline that feels more accessible to ordinary, non-professionally trained people, she said. In early January, at the AHA's annual meeting in Philadelphia, every member of the association's council, including Sweet, voted in favor of the new scholarship guidelines. That evening, I found Grossman holding court, wine glass in hand, elated and punchy. "This might be my biggest accomplishment," he confided in a friend. Despite the celebratory mood, the Sweet affair was still in the back of people's minds. Sweet had been charged with putting together a series of panels for the conference, and one was on movements to defund the police. In December, one of the speakers, Devarian Baldwin, an urbanist and historian at Trinity College, tweeted that he had resigned from the panel. Quote, "This would have been an amazing conversation. However, this is a presidential session for someone who would caricature my work as presentist," end quote. When I asked Baldwin later by phone why he declined to participate in the conversation, he told me it was a matter of integrity. "I'm black and I'm trained in African American history, and that compels me to say that the idea that politics is just now entering history is a perspective of extreme white privilege," he said. "When you bring a critical lens to the story, particularly being from a marginalized community, it's like, okay, you're using identity politics and presentism as if identity politics hasn't always been present when it was all white historians." He felt that Sweet's decision to call out a black tourist family and Nicole Hannah Jones was nasty, especially given that Sweet's entire academic career has focused on the African diaspora. He must know that way in which African historians and African experiences have been politically marginalized from the historical profession, Baldwin said. He was impatient with Sweet's implicit warning to historians against getting too involved in political debates where history is used and abused. Quote, "We fight that by coming together and producing good history, good knowledge, not by turning inward and saying, I'm going to go away and write my book." The panel went on without Baldwin. At times, they seemed to be arguing with Sweet, even though he was not there. They described why they're not afraid to be called a presentist. Everyone nodded along as Elizabeth Hinton, a professor of history, African American studies, and law at Yale, laid out a vision for the field. Quote, "It's not just about doing history. It's necessarily part of this larger political, social project to help us achieve a more egalitarian and just society." Historians are the first to point out that there are no new debates. Members of the profession have always argued about the role politics should play in the writing of history. Old debates can have new chapters, however, and Sweet has become a stand-in for the fight over how historians should meet the urgency of this current moment in American life, the risk of sitting battles out, and the risk of getting too invested. Blight, the Yale historian, warned that scholars who focus too much on winning today's political battles may lose the war over history. The best history, the history that will hopefully stand up over time, is going to be deeply researched, he told me. Otherwise, the profession will lose its authority. Otherwise, we won't really be listened to. In December, for his final column in Perspectives as the president of AHA, Sweet decided to write about his son, Aiden. 2.5 years ago, Aiden died at the age of 17 after he accidentally overdosed on fentanyl. He had been dealing with a lot, anxiety and depression related to the pandemic, his parents' divorce, and the homicide of a close friend. According to Sweet, Aiden, whose mother is a black South African woman, was also frequently harassed by the police because of his race. In his column, Sweet described how, after Aiden's death, he retreated into work on a manuscript about a mutiny on an 18th century British slave ship. One day, as he was looking through his archival materials, he caught a reference to the use of laudanum, an opiate. His breath caught. He read further, discovering that the ship captains at times used laudanum to drug and enslave Africans or kill those aboard their ships who suffered from disease. Aiden pushed me toward these revelations, Sweet wrote. The day I sat down to write this one paragraph section of the chapter, I sobbed. I asked Sweet why he would share this part of his life in Perspectives. He said that, in some small way, he saw it as an opportunity to answer the critics of his September column. We're always shaped by our present, he told me. The question is, what do you do with it? He didn't turn the paragraph on laudanum into a reflection on the opioid crisis or the Sackler family. It just sits. It's one paragraph, and it moves on, he said. It has meaning to me, but there's nothing in that book that intimates that I have suffered. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.